family. It happened to be the cornerstone that we build this community around.
It's our members, it's our family. We all pray here. We didn't get the disease. We don't know where they are. We're trying to put all of them together in our funeral home.
This is your police department. You see, this is your police department. We support you.
I couldn't do anything. I was just here. I couldn't even go out there. I didn't even go to the building. I remain here.
And that are some of the voices of the Bronx after the tragic fire that killed 17 people, 9 of them children, on Sunday. And that's from the news for Tuesday, January 11, 2021. The news is produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson from New York City. I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for listening.
This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. The previous program was the WBAI Evening News, heard daily at 6 p.m. It's now 6:31 p.m. Stay tuned for Extinction Rebellion Radio coming up.
You're listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI.
Welcome to the Rebellion.
This is Extinction Rebellion Radio with Elise Lane and Matthew Kearney. Extinction Rebellion is an international movement that uses nonviolent direct action to press for action on the climate emergency. Last week, most of our program was devoted to an interview with Shukash Bedarian. Now, she is the environmental correspondent for Marjan Television, a Farsi language network that is based outside of Iran. And for that reason, it's able to criticize the Iranian government. Now, our time slot on this program is 30 minutes, and our interview with Shuka went for over 40. So we had the option of either cutting a chunk of quality material from an award-winning climate journalist or splitting it and sort of, carrying over that interview into a segment this week. And we chose to carry it over. So what follows is a few minutes more on the subject of how the climate crisis is affecting Iran to help enhance our global perspective on what is through and through a global issue. Now, this film was on COP26, which we have talked about on this program, and you were inside the blue zone. You interviewed delegates from many countries. You interviewed the chair of the conference. From the United States, you interviewed John Kerry, Al Gore, others. What were your impressions? What is your take on COP26?
Well, in my documentary, I try to highlight some of the most important topics around the issue of climate change, such as science, climate justice, and activism, as well as in an introduction to what these negotiations are. So we always knew that we weren't going to get everything we wanted at this COP. Mr. Gore said something very interesting during my interview with him. He said that he has been to almost all these conferences since day one. Mm-hmm. And he said that what he learned was not to expect a complete solution or package in one conference. So we have made some achievements and progress this year, But we all know that it is certainly not enough. And therefore, we must keep putting pressure on our world leaders and make 1.5 degrees a reality. What I think needs to be highlighted more than ever, and is what I tried to emphasize on in my documentary, is the historic emissions. Many are still unaware of who is responsible for the cause of climate change in the first place, and why it is so important to demand our world leaders in developed countries to pay what was promised, which is the annual $100 billion to the poor developing countries being affected the most by climate change and need the financial aids to shift to renewable sources of energy.
Well, to Mr. Gore, who in fairness is not here to explain and defend himself, but to Mr. Gore, even if we grant the premise that we can't get a comprehensive solution from any one conference, can we get a partial solution from any one conference? Can we get some emissions cuts? Can we get some plan for short, medium, long term? Can we get something that's verifiable, enforceable? I didn't find it coming from COP26. I'm not sure Mr. Gore is being very helpful in excusing the situation. Toward him, not toward you. What do you think?
No, because I think we have, obviously, as an activist, I'm going to just talk about how I feel about it. I think we cannot certainly lose hope and give up. We still need to do what it takes to get what we want, which is a livable planet. And that means keeping the average temperature rise below 1.5 degrees. So we managed to come down from 2.7 to 2.4, which is still nearly a degree higher than what we wanted. You know, higher than what we must get, which is 1.5 degrees. So, you know, obviously I mentioned the historic emissions and that $100 billion, which is a big deal. You know, if we need that global collective collaboration in order to move forward and try to get to a place where we can, you know, still live and survive on this planet. So I would take that as a positive achievement, progress, I would say. But unfortunately, we know that we don't have a lot of time. So what is also, to me, hopeful is that we are going to review the NDCs of the countries next year at COP27. So I think we still have, opportunity to try to push for it and, make what we want a reality, which is, again, I keep repeating that, reaching that 1.5 degrees.
I'm still waiting to hear what will be done to achieve 2.4, let alone 1.5. What will be done other than discussing it further next year at COP27? I don't think we got the answer from COP26.
Well, the problem is that, you know, these legally binding, agreements, at the end of the day, it comes down to every single nation and how they, you know, each country is going to, follow their commitments and doing what they've promised to do. So that is something a bit challenging and hard to, you know, have a proper, precise answer to. One thing that I have learned, and I think it's very important, because sometimes we see that in Iran with all these very depressing environmental news and issues that we have, you know, to a point where we know some of our natural resources, lakes and wetlands, are not going to be restored, you know, and go back to the state that they were many years ago. But it is important. We don't want people to give up. You know, right. We need people we need someone to take action. And I think, to me, that's people. That's the power of people. And people can make this happen. So
that's right.
In order to get there, I think we need to still make sure that that hope, that sense of, you know, optimism and hopefulness is in them in order to, you know, take action. so we can actually, you know, tackle the climate crisis and do what needs to be done.
Power of people was much in evidence in Glasgow. The footage from your film makes it clear you went outside, you saw those huge protests. I was there too. Now, it's easy to say, in looking at those protests, it's easy to say, well, the youth are so inspiring and they are the future. In fact, it is easy to say that. It's also hard not to say that. But to throw yet another big, complicated question at you, you've said yourself that we're running out of time. You've said yourself that, you know, there's going to be sections of Iran, maybe large sections of Iran, that might be uninhabitable as soon as 20 years from now. So if we just wait for this generation, the currently young generation, if we wait for them to age into positions of influence, well, it's going to be much too late. So what is your assessment of climate activism, our movement? How are we doing? Should we be doing things differently?
Well, the youth activism in Glasgow was inspiring. But what we need to know is that there's never just one solution to a problem, especially a complex problem like climate change. So we cannot simply say only the youth movement can get us where we want to be, or only businesses can solve this problem. I think we need the young and the old. We need the business leaders as well as the world leaders. And we need people from every level of society to demand urgent action. What we need to do is to keep having these conversations, raising awareness, creating a sense of urgency and responsibility, building a global movement of united citizens who are after a more just and livable, if not greener world.
Yeah, let me say, you know, one of the things that I think is also on the horizon is that environmental activists, and coming to terms with the climate crisis, are really just beginning to challenge the logics of a nation state. And I think that's when I heard you talk about the Iranian government going after environmental activists. And it's part of the larger, you know, problem of dealing with people who are, you know, resisting the system. But you also see that happening here, where there's, you know, there's the development of a legal framework to go after environmentalists, to create laws that make, you know, that criminalize protesting at oil infrastructures and so forth. And I see that, you know, as nations come to terms with the fact that there's a movement of people who are like saying, this is a global issue requiring global, a very different global approach. That requires us to sort of really call into, or not delegitimize, but just to, you know, subsume the idea of a nation state for a larger global arrangement. I think that's very threatening, and that that's what we're, you know, the environmentalists are facing that more and more, and people who are trying to deal with climate change are seeing the limits of the nation state.
Absolutely. I organized an event at COP for the Climate Reality Project as a climate reality leader. And again, the event was called How to Achieving a Climate Justice. And obviously, we talked a lot about how climate change is a social justice issue and impacting the, you know, the most vulnerable and marginalized communities around the world. And one of the scientists that I had on my panel, Professor Amir Arakuchak, said something very interesting. He said, we need to think of, you know, environment as a body with rights. If we can somehow have that written in our international laws, then we can actually go and claim for it when it's violated.
This is WBAI 99.5 FM, and you're listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio with Elise Lane and Matthew Kearney. And you're hearing us wrapping up our interview with Shuka Bedarian, environmental correspondent for Marjan Television, a Farsi language news network. And we're discussing how the climate crisis is impacting Iran.
So, you know, people have the right to clean air and clean water. And at the moment, we don't have that. So all these are being violated, but we don't have the right laws to actually go out there and say, this has been violated. This is my right. You know, this is the environment's right. We need to look after it. It's being violated. Something needs to be done.
And that's that's a decolonized framework, because it puts it actually brings our relationship to the rest of Earth and to all the other sentient beings. It makes it prioritizes that relationship in ways that colonialism has destroyed that relationship.
Just take and, you know, whatever you want without thinking of how our natural resources are going to regenerate. It's quite sad. And as you mentioned, unfortunately, it's going to take a long time to make that change. And at the moment, what we need is, faster, more speedy solutions and alternatives to try to not fix the problem, but at least make sure that it's not going to get worse.
Yeah.
Well, Shuka, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Now for the Tower Fund Drive. WBAI is doing a fundraising drive currently as we're recording this in December, and we encourage all of you to contribute. Their idea is to raise as much toward this year's rent as possible, so we have less fundraising to do later on. And these are basic costs: rent for the office and rent for the antenna that beams the programs over the radio waves and into your car or into your home, or if you have one of those portable radios, then into that box you're carrying around with you.
You can contribute to this Tower Fund Drive by going to WBAI.org. And there's a big banner right there on the homepage that says in bold letters, "Donate to Tower Fund." You can't miss it. So WBAI.org and click on "Donate to Tower Fund." If you prefer to donate by phone, you can also call the WBAI call center at 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. As you all probably know, this is a listener-supported station. This type of fundraising is essential to the station's existence. So donate today. Call 212-209-2950 or go to WBAI.org and click on Donate to Tower Fund. We and WBAI would really appreciate it. Thank you.
You know, in October, the House Committee on Oversight and Reform launched a series of hearings into Big Oil's longstanding disinformation campaign to prevent climate action. That's the name they gave it: Disinformation Campaign to Prevent Climate Action. Progressive and not so progressive politicians are now eager to present themselves as opponents of the industry for its decades of lies about the science of climate change and for its role in worsening the ongoing disaster. The chair of the committee, Representative Carolyn Maloney, has even threatened to subpoena fossil fuel companies for the relevant documents to pursue the committee's investigation. Now, it sounds like good news, perhaps, yet there's something wrong with this picture. An article on NPR's website has examined the history of the oil companies on this issue and has come to a conclusion that will probably surprise no one listening to this program, namely that decades of deception by big oil had repeatedly paralyzed all federal attempts to control climate chaos. A number of these companies funded internal studies proving that human-made climate change was not only real, but an imminent threat. Yet the companies then spent billions of dollars trying to convince the public that the science was flimsy or inconclusive. And meanwhile, Exxon certainly trusted its own climate research. The company used its projections to modify plans for its Arctic operations so as not to sacrifice profits.
Truth for me, not for thee, says Exxon. The Kyoto Protocol was a turning point in all of this. In the mid-1990s, climate activists urged the United States to sign on to the Kyoto Protocol, which would have established concrete goals to limit greenhouse gas emissions. And boy, it would have made a big difference to do that in the 1990s compared to today. But the fossil fuel industry cleverly exploited a fatal flaw in the treaty. That treaty had a different standard for developing countries. At the time, China was still classified as a developing country. So appealing to good old American xenophobia, The fossil fuel industry argued, in effect, that two wrongs make a right, and that it was okay for China to pollute. So should the United States. The result was that in 1997, the Senate voted unanimously against ratifying the Kyoto Treaty. The unanimity is amazing. Not a single Democrat in power wanted to ratify the Kyoto Protocol, nor did a single Republican in power. The history thus reveals a depressing pattern. Every time there was a decent chance to get a handle on the problem, no significant action was ever taken. There were at least three reasons for this. Of course, there's more, but three of the reasons are direct and easy to perceive. One, enormous donations by the fossil fuel industry to the political campaigns of powerful politicians. Two, misinformation disseminated by the industry, which may have led some lawmakers to actually believe that the crisis either wasn't happening or was exaggerated. And three, the industry's ability to sway public opinion, with the result that intimidated politicians who should have known better voted against their consciences. So the problem was not just the wealth and power of a bloated industry, but the cupidity, timidity, and stupidity of elected officials. To put it another way, the power of a conspiracy of rich companies to corrupt the political progress met a Congress that was all too eager to be corrupted. That Senate vote on the Kyoto Protocol will long be remembered, but the House of Representatives has not exactly been passing a lot of bold climate-saving legislation. So when congressional committee members point the accusing finger at fossil fuel executives, remember that in doing so, they're also pointing a finger backward at themselves.
There was a massive storm in British Columbia. We might call it an India-level storm. The British Columbian Minister of Transportation, Rob Fleming, said it was the, quote, worst weather storm in a century, unquote. Minister of Public Safety, Mike Farnworth, said he had, quote, no doubt that the storm was linked to climate change. No doubt, he says. That is a direct quote. It is the most expensive natural disaster in the history of Canada. It happened in November 2021. If you know people who still think that bad effects from the climate crisis are far in the future, tell them to listen to this segment. Canada just had the costliest natural disaster it has ever had. It could cost $1 billion Canadian to rebuild from it. But to offer Canada some unsolicited advice, maybe think long and hard before deciding where and how to rebuild. It might not be sensible to spend $1 billion just to put everything right back where it was. Think about whether it's going to flood again, if it can be mitigated with some design changes. If it's going to flood again and it can't be mitigated, then don't rebuild there. If you must build, build somewhere else. People will say their lives are being disrupted by having to move. But in fact, it's the other way around. You're saving them a great deal of trouble by giving them notice and allowing them to move in a more planful and deliberate way instead of only having to move once you get hit by another disaster without the luxury of planning for it, not to mention everything you would lose from such a disaster, assuming you even survived it. So it saves lives and resources if, in an inevitably flooding space, people are in fact forced to move. Now, you're going to hear this term again, atmospheric river. That's the meteorological phenomena that created the strip of wet weather that dropped the region's average monthly rainfall in just 24 hours. I feel like I've heard that one before. A month's rainfall in 24 hours. Articles in other parts of the world have said exactly the same thing, reporting on their local circumstances. And I mean word for word. Coming soon to an area near you, atmospheric rivers, and a full month's worth of rainfall in 24 hours.
A court in the Netherlands ordered Shell Oil to steeply reduce its emissions, exactly what we've been calling for. Now, Shell is headquartered in the Netherlands. Its official name is Royal Dutch Shell, which is why a Dutch court has jurisdiction. In fact, Shell is the largest publicly traded company in the Netherlands. So this is pretty significant for the Dutch economy, right? Shell's response is runaway. Rather than comply and risk a short-term revenue loss, they are going to relocate to London to make themselves officially a British company. They're changing their name, too, cutting the words Royal and Dutch. They figure that on the other side of the channel, there won't be the same kind of government pressure to help your fellow humans as there is in the Netherlands. Now, wherever their new headquarters building is will become a natural protest target. Shell's board of directors issued a statement saying this has nothing to do with that court judgment. Yeah, that's unlikely. Now, Shell is fleeing its legal responsibility and its moral responsibility. For Shell, it's, you know, we'd rather take it easy and keep the profits than do something for humanity. We hope this sort of thing will strengthen the resolve against fossil fuel companies. But there's a fear that it will have opposite effect, that it will, you know, make courts and governments less likely to take climate measures if the companies can just relocate. Global cooperation can solve that problem. Global cooperation is what has always been required.
This is WBAI 99.5 FM, and this is Extinction Rebellion Radio with Elise Lane and Matthew Kearney. We're talking about a massive storm in British Columbia and Shell Oil fleeing its legal responsibilities by moving headquarters and changing its name. Extinction Rebellion Radio is on WBAI every Tuesday from 6:30 to 7 p.m. We'll close with a few long overdue credits. Christine Williams sound edited our October 26th episode, and Jose Vindas Mora sound edited our November 2nd episode. For the ongoing sound editing support that is currently sustaining this show, big thanks is due to Brandon McMillan and Cheyenne Tang. The time Brandon and Cheyenne put in allows Elise and myself to spend our time generating the content. Thanks are due to Jack Baldwin for contributing a few new segments. And thanks to Mehrak for technical assistance. This has been Extinction Rebellion Radio.
WBAI's local station board, the Pacifica Foundation board responsible for advising local management and operations, is holding its next meeting on Wednesday, January 12th at 7 p.m. The meeting will be the occasion of a delegate assembly to elect WBAI representatives to the Pacifica National Board. Again, the LSB meeting is Wednesday, January 12th at 7 p.m. The meeting will be held through the Zoom remote meeting service. The meeting, accessible to the public, includes an opportunity for public comment. The fastest and easiest way to join the meeting is by using the link on the Pacifica calendar and on the WBAI website. You can also access the meeting by calling 929-205-6099. That's 929-205-6099. And enter this meeting ID, 922-457-2995. That's 922.457.2995. And as if that wasn't enough numbers, we also have a password. The password is 995, like WBAI's frequency, 99.5. So it's 995.995.99. Do you have to contribute to WBAI to access the meeting? No, but we sure hope that you do.
Next WBAI Community Advisory Board meeting will be held on Sunday, January 16th, 2022. The meeting will be held by teleconference calling. The call-in number is 623-600-3766. The ID number is 963-003. Everyone is welcome to call in and join the meeting. Again, the call-in number is 623-600-3766. The meeting ID number is 963-003. Hope to see you at the meeting. The previous program.